Here at Early Excellence, we specialise in early childhood education. We offer expert advice and guidance through training, consultancy and classroom design. With the Early Excellence podcast, we aim to inspire and support you as well as challenge your thinking. So if that's what you're looking for, you've come to the right place. Hello, everybody. I hope you're well. Just a couple of things to tell you about before we get started with the podcast this week. Now, in terms of outdoor learning, we've got lots to share with you here at Early Excellence. So first of all, we've just had the launch of our new outdoor range of resources, and there's a lot there. Loads there for our younger children in terms of our two-year-old children, but also, of course, lots of progression going through from 2 years right the way through to nursery and reception, and then into key stage one as well. Resources that have been curated with real curriculum knowledge and expertise behind it. So well worth having a look. Alongside that, what else have we had? Well, this week we've had the first of our outdoor road shows as well. I was at the outdoor road show event just yesterday, and we really got off to a flying start. So do keep an eye out. There are events coming up and down the country. So we'll probably be coming to a school or a setting somewhere near to you. So do watch out for our outdoor roadshow events, because they're well worth coming along to. All right. So on the theme of outdoors, staying with outdoors, we've got a great episode for you this week on the podcast, which is episode 192. We've got a fantastic guest for you. I interview Catherine Solly. Now, Catherine Solly is a writer, a consultant. She's a former head teacher. She's wonderfully knowledgeable about outdoor learning, and we had such a great chat about all things outdoors. We covered just about everything, I think. We talked about how to create an effective learning environment. We talked about rich experiences. We talked about the role of the adult. There are so many things there that I think you're going to find really useful and interesting. So here you go. Here's my Early Excellence podcast chat with the brilliant Catherine Solly. Catherine, it is absolutely lovely to see you.
It's lovely to be here.
Definitely. Well, it's lovely to see you. Thank you so much for joining us. What we're going to do is we're going to focus on something that I know is very close to your heart and absolutely close to mine as well, and that is outdoor learning. We're going to talk about outdoor spaces, and I thought we'd have a bit of fun with this. I thought we could imagine the best outdoor space. Okay, so imagine money is no object. And space is something that we can decide, okay? And what we're going to do is kind of close our eyes and imagine the best outdoor space and the best possibilities for young children learning outdoors and what that might be, okay? Before we get onto the physical space, from my point of view, I think it's important to talk about the culture around outdoor learning before we get into the actual space itself. Okay, so from my point of view, I think it's important to have positivity around outdoor learning, first of all, to be positive about outdoor learning in terms of the possibilities that it offers and about being outdoors all year round. Presumably you'd agree with that.
Oh, most definitely. I think, we're all 100% washable and dryable, and that's what we often forget. Even as somebody who's passionate about outdoors, there is this thing when it's cold and wet outside that makes it harder to go outside. But then you need your own body's response to the weather, the environment, all the sensory stuff. Sorry about the phone.
Yeah, absolutely. No, don't worry about that at all. It's not a problem. Yeah, no, absolutely. All of the sensory stuff. And I think something that I often say it to people is that, you know, we talk a lot about language, the importance of language development. And of course, it's crucial, and about a language rich environment. But of course, the outdoors is a language-rich environment, isn't it? You know, the sensory experiences of splashing in a puddle, of being outdoors on a freezing cold day, these are providing opportunities, sensory opportunities, that we can't then help but talk about, I think. You know, when children have been running on it, you know, and they've got red cheeks because they're cold and they've got sort of ruddy, you know, cheeks, you can't help but kind of talk about that, can you, I think? You've got to express yourselves in some way. So it's a language-rich environment, I think.
Very much so. And without being there, you don't really understand the environment or develop the language for it. And I think that's why we've got this sort of disconnection with outdoors. I mean, they reckon, I think, 1 in 8 children in England now have no access to a private or shared garden. And in London, that's 1 in 5. I mean, that's a pretty limiting statistic. So then you've got to look at the settings and the schools, because they then provide that major experience for children in terms of outdoors. And if they don't provide it, then we have a very negative situation, sadly.
Definitely, definitely. And the other thing I always think about as well is that when we think about just being outdoors, as human beings, just being outdoors is closely linked to our health, physical health and mental health. You know, that if you think back to lockdown, for example, you know, what, 5 years or so ago, the thing that people really strived for when they really, you know, when it was restricted, was that those short bursts of time when they could be outdoors, out, you know, out of the house. You know, even if that was half an hour or however long it was, people made sure they went for a walk or they made sure they did it, and they felt better for it. And I think when we think about that for young children, children's well-being, health, physical health, but also mental health is crucial. Yeah. And I think we've got to get into good habits in the early years. And I think the outdoors plays a crucial role in that, really.
Yeah. And I think we also need to stop blaming parents. If you're working hard, as most parents are these days, and often working double hard, then the last thing you can do at the end of the day is take your child to the park. Apart from anything else, it's very dark and sometimes quite unpleasant because it is dark. So then you've got the weekend or whenever you've got time off. If you work nights, you know, the complications are incredible. So again, I think it comes back to settings and staff really having this passion and this vigorous drive to take the children outside.
Yes, definitely.
The opportunities for hands-on sensorial opportunities to be within the environment. And that includes things like getting wet and dirty and experiencing things that they won't experience in any other way.
Yes, no, absolutely. I remember actually a long, long time ago now, probably 10 years ago, possibly, sitting next to you at an early excellence conference, and we were chatting away. And I'm sure you told me that you in your setting, when you were ahead at the nursery, that you made sure that you got the right people for the job, that had, when it came to outdoor learning, that they had exactly the right outlook. And that they knew that actually their job was to be out there and to be engaged in what the children were doing. Is that right?
When we interviewed people, we gave them an sort of unofficial test, in that we invited them not to come in their best clothes, and we warned them that they would be inside and outside, and you know they would be observed playing with the children. But that was as much about their own reactions to being outside as almost the children. So the ones that walk around with the coffee cup, you know, with the lid on, clutched as their most precious item in front of them on a cold day, or a cool drink on a hot day, something like that gets in the way of the interaction with small children. And the younger the child, the more it gets in the way. So the ones who lost that very quickly, you know, would get down to the real interactions. And the other thing would be, a child would come up with a worm or a spider or a beetle or something they'd found in the garden with a little bit of encouragement, because you could bet there wouldn't be that worm around. And just sort of hold it in front on their hand and say, look, And then we watched to see how they would react. It didn't mean, you know, if you were, say, frightened of spiders or worms or whatever it was, you had to touch it, but you had to interact positively with the child, value what they'd found, try and find out a bit more about why they were interested in it, and, you know, take their learning on, because that's part of play. Yeah. And
absolutely,
those that it did these things were definitely on the, you know, the right list of being employed. But it was also a chance for them to find out about us and our ethos, our culture and beliefs, because you were going to be a very round peg in a square hole or square peg in a round hole if you didn't like outside, even though the clue was in the name of open air. And just fascinated me how some people just apply for a job. They don't research it. And yet there are really good matches for people. And then they become part of that psychology of championing outside. And, you know, I've seen many colleagues go on and prosper in other settings and take the outdoor message on because, you know, they believed in it from the word go.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that is crucial, isn't it? You've got to have adults who are absolutely on the same page and understand the value of it and understand that their role in it is to be engaged in it and be part of it.
Yeah.
Really. Okay. So that's our starting point. Now let's move on to what we're going to see, you know, what the physical environment then. So we're talking about going from inside to outside, aren't we?
Yes.
Which is an interesting thing in itself. Okay.
Yeah.
From my point of view, if I'm really picturing effective practice, I'm picturing the door open, first of all, you know, which I know sounds like an odd thing to say, but I'm picturing the door open and propped open so that there's no physical barrier between inside and outside, that actually children can go between in and out. And we're taking the pressure off kind of whether I can or I can't go outside, because I think sometimes that's stressful for children, that sometimes they feel that they're stuck inside and they can't get out. And there's all sorts of systems sometimes in place in different settings that mean that children can't go from inside to outside. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And I think, you know, it's those complications as adults that we need to remove. I mean, even those sort of plastic strips that, you know, the butchers used to have, that people have in order to keep the heat in and what have you, for some children act as a barrier. And for some children, their own life experience will act as a barrier to going outside. I mean, if you've grown up in a refugee camp, perhaps you don't want to go outside so much. But if there are obstacles put in your way that might involve, you know, putting on a badge or being with a certain group of children, or ducking through plastic strips, or actually pushing a door open, then maybe you're never going to go outside. So we've really got to think about it from the child's perspective. Also things, you know, the sensorial things for some children with special educational needs and disabilities, that standing in the doorway is often quite a powerful experience because it's schematic. They're going from one atmosphere into another atmosphere, and that will take some of them time. Others, they'll just go through it like a bolt of lightning, and then they will stop still. Others will go through and they'll need to stand and watch and observe what other children are doing because it's very, very unfamiliar, and others will be like ducks to water and float.
Okay, so we've moved from inside to outside, and we're standing in the outdoor space that we are going to close our eyes and imagine. Okay, what is it that we're aiming for here? If you've got this dream vision of an outdoor space, what sorts of things would spring to mind first of all?
Well, I think, you know, people worry about space. I've seen superb pedagogy and practice in tiny spaces. And I've seen the same in large spaces. I think you can actually have too large, because for small children, it can be very intimidating. But it's how you use that space. If you break it down into zones, rooms, whatever areas, whatever you want to call them, then it becomes much more familiar to children who are used to rooms. You know, even if you're in a very small flat, you have that separation of spaces. So if you have some sort of separation, and I don't mean great big thick walls, but barriers that they can get round or stand next to, then it helps them understand, oh, this space is doable, it's manageable. And it also means that the children feel secure. It's another sort of schema. It's an enclosure that makes them feel safe. So I think how you arrange the outside really matters. And things like fixed equipment can sometimes be really difficult because often they're plonked right in the middle and then everybody has to sort of work around whatever it is, the climbing frame, the slide, et cetera, et cetera. And whilst those pieces of equipment are important, where they are placed and if perhaps they don't need to be permanent, they can be temporary ones that are moved at certain areas or brought out at certain times, again, it will alter the children. But if you think from babies onwards, really, they don't need a huge space, but they need a space that they can explore safely, that has got the appropriate amount of shade, from the sun and, you know, something to protect them from the rain, but not actually stop them from experiencing those things. So it depends on the age and the developmental phase of the child, what experiences are going to be provided in that space.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the, I was just very interested in what you were just saying about kind of shelter from the sun, definitely. Some shelter from rain, perhaps, but at the same time, not going overboard with that. You know, I've worked with many schools and settings where that kind of sheltering from the rain has become almost like an obsession, really, that actually they've felt that they had to have an outdoor area that is completely covered and that there's a great big kind of awning, shelter that comes out from the building. And you just stand in a space that's like that and you think, well, we're kind of one wall away from it being inside here. You know what I mean? That actually you could put up one wall at the far end there and you're practically inside again. It's not the same, I think. And so I think there is a place for some kind of cover or shelter near to the building where actually we could maybe use it as a getting ready for going outdoors space, a waterproof and Wellington boot store, transition space that would be perfect. Beyond that, I think actually you don't need that much cover.
No.
I think if anything, you're right. I think actually shelter from the sun is, to my mind, probably more important in terms of health, really.
Yeah, yes. And I think, you know, going back to what you said about welly boots and clothing, they need to be close to that door with some seating.
Yes.
I mean, I can't put welly boots on without sitting down, so why should a small child? Ability to, you know, choose your boots, find your boots, find your whatever to go outside, or put the sunscreen on, or whatever it might be, whatever time of the year, in that transition zone is important. And also that zone then acts as a storage space, and it can be for things like woodwork and things like that, but perhaps would be noisier inside, but need a bit more protection than outside in the full sun or whatever. But I think the other thing we forget is trees provide shelter. So even in winter, there is that element where one side of the tree will be more affected by weather than another. And it's fascinating how children work that one out. Or they'll watch the down pipes coming out from the kitchen and they'll see the steam arising in the winter. I remember an Ofsted inspector and I having a very interesting conversation about whether this was science or what have you after the children and I had been talking about it. But that's what you get outside. That's the richness, the unpredictability that you don't have inside in the same way. So,
And all of those natural experiences, the tree that's planted and that you've then got the leaves that will fall perhaps in the autumn, or you've got other natural opportunities that come from that, you're putting in place. Yes, you're planting the tree or you're making sure you've got the natural experiences, but you're also, I suppose, leaving space for the the kind of the happy accidents. Yeah. That when you've got a tree and then you've got piles of leaves, then you've got the opportunity to find a living creature. You know, there's a knock on effect there, isn't there? That you have, because you have these different natural experiences, the chances of finding something which is a happy accident are greater.
Yeah, it's a sort of knock on plan that once you have one tree, or, you know, far be it from me to suggest a small orchard, but that has other benefits. Yes. That provides something all the year round, you know, from the bare winter branches to the buds coming in spring with, you know, the leaves, the blossom, then, you know, the shade through the summer, and then perhaps fruiting in the autumn and harvesting. You've got a pattern to your year, which will provide huge richness of learning experiences with very little else. So even if you're growing a tree in an oil drum, you've got something that is real positive and that is real, you know. And how many children actually get to appreciate, to draw a tree, to touch a tree, to model it out of clay, or to do rubbings and buds, or, you know, bark and things like that? There are lots of possibilities, aren't there?
Absolutely. No, there are. The other thing that struck me as well about what you were saying just before about kind of sectioning off the spaces to provide kind of zones and so on is that, particularly outdoors, you can do that in so many interesting ways, can't you? You know, that trellis with plants growing up, or pots with bamboo in, or small trees, or whatever it might be. There are loads of ways of providing a kind of a suggestion of sections without it being really completely enclosed.
No, I mean, I don't mean to enclose the areas, but it sort of creates them. And that also helps the children know what resources are there, where those resources are stored, and where they need to go back to. You know, it's obvious things like sand pits and sort of a water area that there will be storage nearby. But other areas, say, you know, like construction, you will have a lot of loose parts that aren't so easily stored, but need to be thought about in terms of how the children access these things, that deal with them, and then are involved in the putting away, which is often the painful bit.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. No, definitely. Which brings us on quite nicely to that idea of the organisation and also then the resourcing. So we're looking around this space, and certainly from my point of view, I think it makes sense to have storage for resources that is then near to where you've got those resources and where they're going to be used. That, yes, you know, you could have one very large shed with lots and lots of things in, and that can work, but then you're expecting lots of things to be transported right the way across the space before you've even started, really. Whereas actually, if you can go out and open up sheds and have that set of water resources exactly where they need to be from the start, I think that's taking away some of the logistical burden, really.
Yeah, it's because children are children. I can remember a group of children, and I forget which buildings we'd been looking at that were being built out in the local community, but they were busy building both in the construction area and the sandpit area. And then one day, some of the sand got transported in wheelbarrows to the construction area. And some of the staff were a little bit shocked that, you know, this could be happening, because sand stays there and blocks and building stuff stays there. And I said, well, you know, they've transported it. They'll have to find a way to transport it back again, and, you know, use some problem solving and some critical thinking and creative thinking, you know, to get it back again. So we can plan all we like. We can organize all we like. But those things will happen. But the thing about big sheds, and I hate big sheds, I like small sheds if you're going to have them, because they need the access. And if you've got the stuff for the children lower down, you can have adult stuff higher up, so that there are a few things that are more precious, or where the iPads go, or, you know, those sort of things, you know, scissors, knives, perhaps. So, again, it's about thinking about your environment, your ethos, your culture, and how you resource those areas outside.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So already then we're getting a picture, aren't we, of this outdoor space. We've got We've got a welly store, a transition area underneath the cover next to the door to outdoors. We've got a bench to sit on to change out of our shoes and into our Wellington boots. It's stored effectively with waterproofs, presumably, and somewhere to put our shoes, I would think, as well. When we've taken your shoes off, where are we going to put them?
One other thing that is quite useful in that transition area, things like weather boxes or boxes that support certain likely experiences outside, like mini beasts and things like that. So again, you've got a box you can just go and grab if it's a frosty morning, and you've got things in there that you can use with the children anywhere outside.
Absolutely.
Or even just on a piece of bare tarmac, because it is that sort of grabability in terms of storage that really matters.
Yes. So that would, and that's the perfect place to store those materials, isn't it? So that you've just got it as easy as possible to just grab them and bring them straight out. And so we've got a covered space. We've got a transition area that's really well organized. We've got the materials sort of enhancement boxes, like a windy day box, a mini beast box, those sorts of things. Then we come outside, then we've got the space sectioned off, and we've got natural opportunities like trees and plants and other things, so that we've got that, the natural experiences. So then let's move into then how are we using the different spaces that we've got? What would be your go-to experiences? What would be your priorities, do you think?
The largest sandpit you can possibly manage, a gardening area, climbing, balancing, gliding area, an area for trajectories, for balls, for things to be thrown, because a lot of people don't like things going through the air. Almost needs to be a sort of target practice area, you know, enter all ye who give up of the door, basically, because some people love to be able to throw, and their parents won't let them do it, and the adults won't let them do it inside, so they go outside. And, you know, even if it's air balls, you know, the balls with holes in, they need to be able to throw it in a relatively safe space where they're not going to do harm, but they're going to get the satisfaction, the physical and emotional satisfaction of being able to throw things. So again, when you're thinking out these areas, zones, rooms, whatever you want to call them, thinking about schematic behaviours, I think, matters, because that feeds into the physicality and their natural development. And they won't all be the same, thankfully.
Yes. No, definitely. So a games type area with balls and things for throwing and so on. Okay. A climbing type space, you were saying, sort of with sort of opportunities to clamber up.
Yeah, I was going to say. Ladders.
Yeah.
And not 20-foot jobs, the short ladders that are ideal, because a small child, a 3-4-year-old can carry those quite easily. Even a fairly old 2-year-old can manage them. And they learn so much about the physics, you know, of how you balance something like that so that it doesn't drop down or flip backwards. And the only way of learning those physics of physicality is by doing it. But when you tell parents that your child has been learning about physics, you know, they're wowed. But if they see kids wandering around with ladders, they're not often so impressed. So again, giving the parents the knowledge of what their child is learning about and why they're throwing balls or moving ladders around or creating structures from the A-frames that might be, you know, about dens, which again, this is why the sort of area thing becomes quite fluid, because if the children are leading the learning, then sometimes the area won't perhaps look like what you intended it to be, you know, because A-frames make beautiful dens, and children will, you know, go and find large pieces of fabric and tarpaulin and make them into dens rather than climbing structures.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And certainly from my point of view, I would always go for something like a number of A-frames and ladders and planks of wood and things like that, that are movable. For me, that offers more valuable than a fixed piece of equipment. There can be some value in some fixed equipment. So monkey bars and things like that can be useful, of course. They can be great. But a lot of fixed equipment tends to be fairly restricting, I think, to a point, in that, you know, once you've kind of climbed up the ladder and once you've gone down the slide, you've kind of done it. Whereas if you have A-frames and planks and ladders and the things that you've described, you're right, it can become a den one day. It can. We can challenge ourselves in different ways. Some children will just find challenge in balancing on a plank that's on the floor, literally being millimetres off the ground. Other children will pick up that plank and rest it on the bottom bar of the A-frame. And for them, walking up that slight slope, that's a challenge. For other children, they'll place the plank almost across the top of the A-frame and they'll be walking across it at a, you know, quite a height. And for them, that's challenge. And I think the risk and challenge involved in that go hand in hand. There is a risk there, but it's a risk. It feels risky for that child who is just balancing on the ground, millimeters off the ground, you know, that on a plank, just millimeters off the ground. It also feels challenging and risky for a child who's, you know, working at a greater height than that. But it's about, for me, it's about appropriate risk and about that child feeling, being at the edge of what they can do, I think is important.
Yeah, very much so. I think we also need to distinguish between what is hazardous and what is risky, because yes, we all do things that are risky throughout life.
Yes.
You know, growing up, well, being born is risky. Growing up is another risk. But because hazards are removed, and that's part of the adult's job, you know, that's why you have your check every morning round, and you keep an eye on the status of the equipment and what have you, so there's no splinters or sharp bits, those sort of things. You have removed the majority of the worst hazards, you know, and yes, two children find something to put the plank on to make a seesaw. You know, that is risky, but it's essential, again, you know, for the physicality and the whole experience of balancing, but also the science and the understanding that it leads to as well. So, yes, again, we could be in danger of saying, you know, this is too dangerous. This is, you know, not going to happen.
Yeah, that risk and challenge is interesting. I think it also comes down to knowing your children, and it also comes down to supervision, of course, and being there and being present.
Yeah. If they trust you, you will see some children look at you almost for a sort of clarification nod. You know, this is okay, yes, you can do it. The little ones who, you know, are less experienced will come along and stand by you and watch.
Yes.
I remember we had a child on the autistic spectrum, and he was doing a seesaw, but he was walking up the seesaw, working out the tipping point and what have you. And he did it for ages, and there was a little refugee girl standing next to me, and she watched him for all that age. And when he moved on, she went and tried it, but she needed that time and the security of being with an adult to know it was okay for her to try it too. And so she, you know, her development went on a huge leap by us giving, yes, her the time, the space, the trust to observe, rather than saying, oh, you can do it, you know, rush in, where angels fear to tread, et cetera, et cetera, and off you go. But she did it in her own terms, at her speed, and was highly successful then. So, you know, two children benefit from, and he got the benefit of being the leader and teaching her, in inverted commas, how to do it.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So we've got, so far, we've talked about the transition space. We've talked about coming outside and having the natural opportunities. Also, think the larger opportunities, like the A-frames and the planks of wood and the ladders and things like that. We've talked about the balls and the kind of the games area. What else? Water play? Would that be on your list of priorities? Okay.
Yep. Water.
Can you describe that for us?
Well, again, this can be pretty open-ended, because I think one of the essentials outside is an outdoor tap. Because if you've got an outdoor tap, you can ferry water in buckets and watering cans. You can put a hose on it, et cetera, et cetera. But spending hours filling up water trays and things like that, children will fill a water tray up quite happily. That's part of the learning. They get the physical benefits of carrying the buckets or the watering cans. And maybe on a cold day, they don't want to put their hands in cold water anyhow. So it needs to be flexible and open-ended. So if the resources are there, they can go and turn the tap on and fill up the bucket and start pouring it in. And also they can go and get their watering can and go and water, you know, the plants in the garden. And having something like a water butt actually can teach them about rationing, you know, that when it's gone, then, oh, the plants aren't going to get a drink, you know, and we're not allowed to use the tap because, you know, that there's a ban on using water like that. So again, it becomes a bigger picture of learning about the earth as well as, you know, a precious commodity of water in our lives. And hoses, things like that for spraying, you know, getting wet.
Yeah.
I've got a wonderful photo somewhere. Well, I think it's about the sort of late 30s, early 40s of children at Chelsea Open Air with a hose pipe. And there's one adult in the picture and she's got the hose, wise woman. But the spray and the joy on their faces, you know, that never changes. That absolute pleasure of seeing the power of water, getting wet and experiencing it. So then what do we do? Oh, we can't go outside because it's raining. You know, I mean, there are double standards here, aren't there? So
there are.
The adults need the right gear as well as the children for the rain.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good message, actually, isn't it? Thinking about, you know, what kit the adults have got. You know, have they got warm coats? Have they got Wellington boots and thick socks? And, you know, so that actually they're in the right gear for being outdoors all year round, because that's half the battle, really, I think, so that we're positive then, really.
So,
okay.
And the water area needs lots of different containers. And, you know, you can find lots of things. When I worked in Albania, I went to the local market and bought baby baths because those were the only containers that I could find for water play. And then I just got people collecting things like yogurt pots and bits of piping and stuff like that. You can be very resourceful, but you can also buy some wonderful water toys that will take children on further. So again, you have to, you know, cut your cloth accordingly.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Okay. What about mud? That's always an interesting one. Mud play. Okay.
I mean, I think mud is essential.
I would say so too.
Yeah.
I would say so. Yeah.
And particularly for the younger ones, people often think, oh, 3 and 4 year olds, fine. But babies need mud, you know, but when they're starting to crawl, that if they're on like a splash suit, an all in one, bare feet and bare hands, and their feet experience it as much as their hands do because they're crawling, they're touching. And I can remember working with a setting in Hampshire and their babies were upstairs. And I said, please either bring some mud upstairs or take the babies down to the other garden where the older children are and let them play in the mud. And I think they were a bit shocked, but they did it and they sent me the photos. And again, the joy, that sort of experiential buzz that babies get of this sort of soft, squishy, but lumpy and unpredictable stuff. The older ones would develop into, you know, lasagna or pie or coffee or whatever it is in the mud kitchen. The younger children, actually, it's just the tactile responsiveness that they need. And that's not just, it's an important experience.
Yeah, yeah.
So
and if we're thinking
of... Sorry.
No, you're all right. No. If we're thinking about what goes into creating, you know, a great mud area, yes, we're going to see imaginative play, as you said, you know, so we're going to be making mud pies probably and mud lasagna and mud coffee and all sorts of things like that. So we need a range of containers, of course, but also different utensils. You know, thinking about the physicality of it, I think is great. So things like a potato masher, you know, and a hand whisk and a sieve and a colander and all of those sorts of physical opportunities to explore the mud. And then I would also be thinking about things like a garlic press and a pestle and mortar and different ways of grinding things and so on. And natural materials, so herbs and other interesting plants around the space, I think is interesting.
Yeah.
You know, so I would agree that mud play should be there throughout, but I would be placing it in an area of the outdoor area where it is reasonably easy to manage, so that you're not, it's not in the middle there where the mud is going absolutely everywhere and somebody's having a fit. You see what I mean? But actually, you've got it enclosed in a corner, and you've kind of grown things around it a little bit, which offers the natural materials, but also the kind of the shelter from the mud going everywhere within the space. Does that make sense?
Well, very much so. And I think, you know, mud can be very wet, sticky mud, or can be limited. And a good loam, which is like the consistency you get from molehills, is the ideal sort of starting point of the earth that you use. Because people say to me, well, where do you get the soil from? I mean, you can buy bags of loam. You don't need to sort of import a lorry load. But actually, when you're starting off and you've got the mud kitchen, you know, the pots and pans, the tools that you've suggested will benefit from having a good loam, because that will actually go with the water to make a good consistency, and it won't become a mud slide. You can get hold of the hose pipe. You know, it will become a usable tactile. The other thing I think you need to think about is where it is in relation to things like sand, gravel, or bark and things like that, because they will go and magpie around and find things to mix in. A setting I know worked really hard, set up this beautiful mud kitchen, and they put it next to their gravel area. And then they had a very large gravel area in the end, because the gravel transported itself into the mud kitchen. And, you know, in the end, it was just dominating the whole thing. So they then had to rethink and move it to a better position. But get that from observing children and knowing, you know, their developmental phases and stages and what they might do with things.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So we've covered a lot, haven't we, already? You know, we've talked about the large-scale water. We've talked about large construction and some den making. We've talked about games. We've talked about mud play. We've talked about the transition space. You mentioned gardening at one point as well. So a space for gardening would be perfect. I think building with other materials. So we mentioned the A-frames, but I would probably add to that things like crates as well. You know, so being able to make a den yourself, or being able to create an obstacle course or something like that. I think crates and planks and other things with
that. A selection of loose parts, both large and small. Again, with good storage. So not having about, you know, 200 pebbles, but maybe 20 pebbles, you know, have an appropriate provision for the number of children you've got. Because if they've got a container full of 200 pebbles, they're going to tip them all out and they're not going to want to put them back again. But if they've got 20 or whatever it might be, then that's much more likely to find its way back at the end of the day. And for the child to actually find what they need. It's like inside, you know, if it was toy cars or something like that. If you have too many, there will be a problem. If you don't have enough, there's another problem. So thinking about the provision of resources, how you store things like guttering, piping, the clips, you know, for fastening things together, good old masking tape, which works inside as well as outside, you know, it will fasten gutters to A-frames or fences or whatever it might mean. And fences are actually a good resource when it comes to building and making dens and things like that, because you can fix things to them.
Yes.
So, you know, people say, my area is surrounded by fence. And you think, well, there are worse things to be surrounded by.
Yeah,
you have to make, you know, the space work outside, whatever it's surrounded by, however big, small, etc., etc. And the garden thing, again, you need to think about where the garden is. It doesn't need to be huge, but that ability, I mean, Froebel had children having little patches of their own, which they didn't have to garden, but they had the opportunity to grow things or just watch the weeds grow if they wanted. So, you know, it's a very long established thing in terms of kindergarten, nursery provision. And it's, again, watching that pathway, that journey from seed or tiny plant into something that fruits that you can harvest. Our grandson is now 5, and he arrived the other day saying, I want to go outside and harvest. And I said, well, I'm sorry, there's not much to harvest. There might be a few cabbages that we can, you know, pick, what have you. But he really sees the garden as somewhere where you grow things and then you harvest it.
Right. Yeah.
And I think, again, it's like the tree. It's that pattern of the year. Getting your hands dirty, using tools and all the fine motor benefits, as well as, you know, gross motor benefits that you get from it. And the sensorial stuff, you know, it's a bit like forest bathing, that you smell the wet earth, petrichor, that is the word that I love, you know, that smell, the smell of the earth rained. All those sorts of things that actually really, really essential for childhood. You know, you don't have to have a tick list and tick them off, but it's part of the experience. No.
It is. It's all part of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. Okay. There are two final things that I wanted to cover. So one is time, okay, and the importance of time. And then the other thing is that I know that you've got a book out, and I wanted to ask you about that just at the end. All right, if that's all right.
Yeah.
The first thing I've just gone through my mind
is maybe a little performance area for sing, dance, and what have you. And, you know, salt boxes with some costumes, not a lot, but maybe a few hats and things like that. Because you add another creative opportunity outdoors, which sometimes gets forgotten, as well as books.
Yeah.
You do all your old books inside, cut them up, laminate them, and put them on those little rings that you use for key rings. Because they're a lot longer outside, and waste not, want not. So, sorry, just call it wisdom in my head.
That sounds good. But you're right. You know, you can be noisier outdoors generally, can't you? You know, you can be more expressive in many ways. So I think it does make sense to have that if there is the space to do it. Okay. So we've talked about the physical space. I felt that we ought to mention time because. Yeah. From my point of view, time is a resource, a really valuable resource. And we've got to be very, I think how we use time has quite a knock-on effect or a direct impact in terms of the quality of what you then see within the space. What guidance would you give people on time, Catherine?
Well, I always say slow down, which is sort of counter to what certain, you know, parts of the status quo, shall we call them, would say, you know, because they want children to go faster and faster. But if we slow down, we reduce the pressure. If we think about the child's developmental phase, that's a good starting point. But giving them enough time to actually build their own capacity outdoors, you know, 15 minutes running around on a tarmac space is not play. By any stretch of imagination, is it? So, you know, if we can somehow weave that opportunity to free flow inside, outside, the children to follow their interests, because sometimes they will need to go inside to follow up what they're doing. And then we're actually growing their grassroots of confidence that we trust them. They know what they're doing. We're there alongside them, you know, supporting them, adding to the benefits of outdoors. It's like having, you know, a few field guides to wildflowers and things like that and trees. There, sooner or later, there will be a child saying, oh, what's that over there? I know that bird from, you know, my garden. And you as an adult, you know, don't really know this. So I remember it was an Eritrean refugee child who said to me, how do giraffes lie down at night? Now, this was a long time ago before we had the internet. And so we phoned London Zoo and she spoke to the curator of giraffes. In those days, those sorts of things. I've not tried it recently, but it might be worth a go. And the curator explained how they did. And then she put the phone down and she said to me, yeah, I know now. And I said, well, are you going to tell me? And she said, no, Catherine, it's for you to find out for yourself. You know, children have this thirst for learning and they will need some sort of factual support for those things as well. But the time thing, I think we really have to negotiate with the senior management team, with the powers above them, to say children need more and more and more of this. And since COVID, they seem to have had less and less and less in a lot of settings and schools, but not all, thankfully, because we're nurturing nature.
Yeah. So, yeah, all of those characteristics of effective learning that we talk about, a lot of them require time, don't they? You know, you talk about developing independence, you talk about becoming highly engaged in something, you talk about having an idea and carrying that idea out. That doesn't happen in 10-minute bursts or 15-minute bursts. That happens in, you know, over an hour, you know, you're talking about really. You need time. And when you watch children come into an outdoor space, even one that's familiar, they don't generally settle straight away. You know, it takes 10, 15 minutes sometimes for them to wander and find something that's really going to interest them today. And they'll pick something up and put it down and then start again. And then gradually, it maybe takes 15 minutes. You might then start to see the children then start to become engaged in something. And then you see the real quality emerging. But if you're only giving them 20 minutes, you're only actually probably giving them 5 minutes of that time. And that doesn't really work. You're not capitalizing on the quality that you could have there, I think. So, yeah, no, I completely agree. I think the longer time you can give the children, the better, really. You tend to see higher quality.
And actually, COVID was one of the benefits of that. A lot of settings and schools actually started outside rather than inside. And so for many children, they got used to being outside. And using the outside more richly than perhaps had happened previous to that. So I think sometimes we see things negatively that actually are positive things, and we could just do that. You know, how about reversing where you meet and greet parents?
If definitely.
Outside, you know, maybe they're more relaxed too. So
yes, absolutely. Now, Catherine, I couldn't let you go without asking you about your new book, because you have a new book out, and it's been wonderful to speak to you about all of the different things that we've talked about. We've covered a lot of ground there. But I also know that people listening to this will be interested and I'm sure inspired and want to know more. And you've written super books, haven't you? And there's a book that you've just written this year that's just come out. Could you tell us all about it?
Yeah, it's called Leading Learning Outdoors from Birth to Seven. And it's my sort of legacy. It's my hand on to folk in early childhood because, you know, I've had a sort of fairly exotic career. I think that's probably the best description. So having this book, drawing together a lot of early years stuff and a lot of my particular interests, leadership being one, I had the Unilever Fellowship, the first early years person to be awarded that. So again, it was a way of embroidering things, but also a way of nurturing the champions of the future for outdoors. So it's a journey from the pioneers, from, you know, the Froebels, the Susan Isaacs, the Margaret Macmillans, et cetera, to actually what we need to ensure for the future for young children. And there are lots of case studies in there, and I'm really grateful to those people. It got rather held up with COVID and my own personal illness and life and what have you. But, you know, I'm really grateful to those people because those case studies make it real. And there's everything from childminders to big outdoor nurseries to small, you know, local familiar day nurseries and what have you. Primary schools, et cetera, and the whole idea was look at the sort of kindergarten stage, a bit like the Scottish are doing, to see it as something from birth to seven, rather than just the EYFS. So to add value.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and you're right. It is something that needs to be passed down, doesn't it? Yeah. You know, these are key messages around outdoor learning and the value of it that I think has to be passed. Basically, from one person to another, from one generation to another, it is important. It's incredibly valuable.
You need to nurture the future. Mm. It won't necessarily be somebody who's on the senior leadership team. It's often the quiet person in the staff meeting who's the real gem. And those are the ones we need to encourage and get them to share their practice with other people and, you know, teach the teachers, basically.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Catherine, it's been brilliant to talk to you. It's been absolutely lovely to catch up with you and to talk through all things outdoors. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you, Andy. Lovely to see you and to have a chat.
So there you have it. Thank you very much, of course, to Catherine for joining us on the podcast this week. And of course, thank you to you people as well for listening too. I hope you found it really interesting. I certainly did. It's always great to chat to Catherine, and I found the conversation, I really enjoyed it. So I hope you did as well. Okay, that's about it from us for this week, everybody. Have a great week, and we will see you next time.